impossible to know. Nor can we be certain about the Titus Latinus at Veii or the hybrid Rutilus Hippocrates at Tarquinii with his Latin first name and Greek second. But they give a clear indication that these places were relatively open communities. It is, however, the story of Servius Tullius that provides the most vivid evidence of the warlords, the private militias, and the different forms of migration, hostile and otherwise, that must have characterised this early society in Rome and its neighbours. It has almost nothing to do with the story of Servius Tullius, the Roman constitutional reformer and inventor of the census. Instead, it seems to offer an Etruscan view, and it comes from the lips of the Emperor Claudius in his speech to the Senate in 48 CE when he urged its members to allow leading men from Gaul to become senators. One of the arguments he used in support of his case was that even the early kings were a remarkably foreign lot. When he reached Servius Tullius, things got even more interesting. Claudius knew a good deal about Etruscan history. Among his many learned researches, he had written a 20-volume study of the Etruscans in Greek, as well as compiling an Etruscan dictionary. On this occasion, he could not resist explaining to the assembled senators, who might have begun to feel they were on the receiving end of a bit of a lecture, that outside Rome there was a different version of the story of Servius Tullius. This was not the story of a man who came to the throne thanks to the favour or scheming of his predecessor, Tarquinius Priscus, and Priscus's wife, Tanaquil. For Claudius, Servius Tullius was an armed adventurer. If we go along with the Etruscan version, he had once been the faithful follower of Caelius Vivenna, and a comrade in his adventures. And later, when he had been driven out by a change of fortune, he left Etruria with all that remained of Caelius's militia and seized the Caelian Hill in Rome, which then became called, after his leader, Caelius. When he had changed his own name, for his Etruscan name was Mastana, he was given the name I have already mentioned, Servius Tullius, and took over the kingdom to the very great advantage of the state. The details that Claudius gives raise all kinds of puzzles. One is the name Mastana. Is that a proper name or the Etruscan equivalent of the Latin magister, which in this context would mean something like boss? And who is the Caelius Vivenna who is supposed to have given his name to the Caelian Hill in Rome? He and his brother, Aulus Vivenna, usually said to have come from the Etruscan town of Vulci, crop up several times in ancient accounts of early Roman history, though in frustratingly incompatible and typically mythic ways. Sometimes Caelius is a friend of Romulus's, sometimes this pair of Vivennas are dated to the time of the Tarquins. One late Roman writer imagined Aulus becoming the king of Rome himself. So was he then one of the city's lost rulers? In Claudius's version, it looks as if Caelius never made it to Rome at all. But what is clear here is the overall character of what Claudius is describing. Rival militias, more or less itinerant warlords, personal loyalty, shifting identities, as different as you could imagine from the formal constitutional arrangements that most Roman writers attributed to Servius Tullius. We get a similar impression from the set of paintings which once decorated a large tomb outside Vulci. Now known as the François tomb, from the name of its 19th-century excavator, it must have been the crypt of a rich local family, to judge from its size, with 10 subsidiary burial chambers opening off an entrance passage and central hall, and from the substantial quantity of gold found there. But for those interested in early Rome, it is the cycle of paintings in the central hallway, which probably date to the mid-4th century BCE, that make it so special. Prominently featured are scenes drawn from the wars of Greek mythology, largely the Trojan War. Balancing these are scenes of much more local fighting. Each character is carefully named, half of them also identified with the name of their hometown, half of them not, presumably indicating that they are men from Vulci, so not needing further identification. They include the brothers Vivenna, Mastana, the only other certain reference to him that survives, and Ignatius Tarquinius from Rome. No one has managed to work out exactly what is going on in these scenes, but it is not difficult to get the gist. There are five pairs of fighters involved. In four of these pairs, a local, Aulus Vivenna among them, is running his sword through an outsider. The victims include Lares Papathnas from Volsiniae and that Tarquinius from Rome. This man must surely be something to do with the kingly Tarquins, even though in the Roman literary tradition the first name of both those kings is Lucius, not Gnaeus. In the final pair, Mastarna is using his sword to cut through the ropes binding the wrists of Caelius Vivenna. One odd feature, and presumably a clue to the story, is that all but one of the victorious local men are naked, their enemies clothed. The most popular explanation is that the paintings depict some famous local escapade, in which the Vivenna brothers and their friends were taken prisoner, stripped and bound by their enemies, but managed to escape and turned their swords on their captors. This is by far the earliest direct evidence to survive for any of the characters in the story of early Rome and their exploits. It also comes from outside, or at least the margins of the mainstream Roman literary tradition. That does not, of course, necessarily make it true. The mythic tradition of Vulci may have been just as mythic as that of Rome. Nevertheless, what we see here gives a much more plausible vision of the warrior world of these early urban communities than do the aggrandizing versions offered by Roman writers and by some of their modern followers. It was a world of chiefdoms and warrior bands, not of organized armies and foreign policy. Archaeology, tyranny and rape. By the 6th century BCE, Rome was certainly a small urban community. It is often tricky to decide when a mere agglomeration of huts and houses becomes a town with a sense of itself as a community, with a shared identity and aspirations. But the idea of a structured Roman calendar, and with it a shared religious culture and rhythm of life, most likely goes back into the regal period. Archaeological traces, too, leave little doubt that by the 6th century BCE, Rome had public buildings, temples, and a town centre, which are clear indications of urban living, even if, in our terms, on a small scale. The chronology of these traces remains controversial. There is not a single piece of evidence on whose dating all archaeologists agree, and new discoveries are always altering the picture, though often not quite so significantly as their discoverers hope. Nonetheless, it would now take a very determined and blinkered sceptic to deny the urban character of Rome at this period. The remains in question are found in several places under the later city, but the clearest impression of this early town is found in the area of the Forum. By the 6th century BCE, its level had been artificially raised, and some drainage work had been carried out, in both cases, to protect the area from flooding. And at least one or two successive gravel surfaces had been laid, so that it could function as a shared central space for the community. The inscription with which we started this chapter was found at one end of the Forum, just beneath the slopes of the Capitoline Hill, in what had been an early shrine with an outdoor altar. Whatever exactly the text means, it was certainly a public notice of some sort, which itself implies the framework of a structured community and recognized authority. At the other end of the Forum, excavations of the earliest levels under a cluster of later religious buildings, including those associated with the Vestal Virgins, have suggested that they go back to the 6th century BCE or even earlier. Not far from there, a few scant remains have been discovered of a series of substantial private houses of roughly the same date. The remains are very scant, but they do give a faint glimpse of some well-heeled big men living in style next to the civic centre. It is hard to know how closely to match these archaeological remains to the literary tradition about the last kings of Rome. It is almost certainly going too far to suggest, as the excavators would like us to believe, that one of those 6th century BCE houses near the Forum was actually the house of the Tarquins, supposing such a thing ever existed. But nor is it likely to be a complete coincidence that the Roman narratives of the last part of the regal period stress the building activities that the kings sponsored. Both the Tarquins were supposed to have inaugurated the great temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill. Later Roman writers found these two kings easy to confuse. And both were said to have built the Circus Maximus and to have commissioned shops and porticos round the Forum. Servius Tullius, as well as having several temple foundations to his name, was often credited with surrounding the city with a defensive wall. This would be another key sign of a sense of shared community, although the surviving fortification, now known as the Servian Wall, is for the most part no earlier than the 4th century BCE. The Italian phrase coined in the 1930s to describe this period, La Grande Roma dei Tarquini, the Great Rome of the Tarquins, may not be so misleading, though it depends a lot, of course, on exactly what is meant by grande. Rome was still, in absolute and relative terms, far from great, but it was a larger and more urban community than it had been 100 years earlier, having profited, no doubt, from its prime position for trading and its proximity to wealthy Etruria. So far as we can judge the town's extent in the middle of the 6th century BCE, part of that judgment inevitably comes down to guesswork, it was now substantially bigger than the Latin settlements to the south, and at least as large as the largest Etruscan towns to the north, with a population of perhaps 20,000 to 30,000, although it had nowhere near the grandeur of some contemporary Greek settlements in Sicily and South Italy, and was significantly smaller. That is to say, Rome must have been a major player in the region, but it was not yet in any way extraordinary. Not all the urban developments that Romans ascribed to the Tarquins were splendid in the obvious sense of the word. It was a characteristically Roman concern for the infrastructure of urban life that made later writers hail their achievements in constructing a drain, the Cloaca Maxima, or the greatest drain. Quite how much of what survives of this famous structure goes back to the 6th century BCE is far from clear. The substantial masonry sections that it is still possible to explore and that still carry part of the overflow from the modern city and the detritus from modern bathrooms are from several centuries earlier, and it now seems likely that the earliest attempts at some kind of drainage system go back earlier to the 7th century BCE. But in the Roman imagination, the cloaca was always a wonder of Rome that was owed to its final kings. An amazing work, and more than words can describe, enthused Dionysius, who presumably had in mind what was visible in his day in the 1st century BCE. Yet it also had a darker side. It was not just a wonder, but also a reminder of the cruel tyranny that for the Romans marked the end of the regal period. In a particularly lurid and gloriously fantastical account, Pliny the Elder, that is Gaius Plinius Secundus, the extraordinary Roman polymath, now best remembered as the one celebrity victim of the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 CE, describes how the people of the city were so exhausted by the construction work on the drain that many killed themselves. The king, in response, nailed the bodies of the suicides to crosses, in the hope that the shame of crucifixion would be a deterrent to others. It was, however, not the exploitation of the labouring poor that was supposed finally to have brought the monarchy down, but sexual violence. The rape of Lucretia by one of the king's sons. This rape is almost certainly as mythic as the rape of the Sabines, assaults on women symbolically marking the beginning and the end of the regal period. What is more, the Roman writers who later told the story were probably influenced by Greek traditions, which often linked the culmination and fall of tyranny with sexual crimes. In 6th century BCE Athens, for example, sexual advances by the ruler's younger brother towards another man's partner were said to have led to the overthrow of the Pisistratid dynasty. But mythic or not, for the rest of Roman time, the rape of Lucretia marked a turning point in politics, and its morality was debated. The theme has been replayed and reimagined in Western culture almost ever since, from Botticelli through Titian and Shakespeare to Benjamin Britten. Lucretia even had her own small party in Judy Chicago's feminist installation, The Dinner Party, among some 1,000 heroines of world history. Livy tells a highly coloured tale of these last moments of the monarchy. It starts with a group of young Romans who were trying to find ways of passing the time while besieging the nearby town of Ardea. One evening they were having a drunken competition about whose wife was best, when one of their number, Lucius Tarquinius Codatinus, suggested they should simply ride back home, it was only a few miles away, and inspect the women. This would prove, he claimed, the superiority of his own Lucretia. Indeed it did. For while all the other wives were discovered partying in the absence of their menfolk, Lucretia was doing exactly what was expected of a virtuous Roman woman, working at her loom among her maids. She then dutifully offered supper to her husband and his guests. There was, however, a terrible sequel. For during that visit, we are told, Sextus Tarquinius conceived a fatal passion for Lucretia, and one evening shortly afterwards he rode back to her house. After being politely entertained again, he came to her room and demanded sex with her at knife point. When the simple threat of death did not move her, Tarquinius exploited instead her fear of dishonour. He threatened to kill both her and a slave, visible in Titian's painting, so that it would look as if she had been caught in the most disgraceful form of adultery. Faced with this, Lucretia acceded, but when Tarquinius had returned to Ardea, she sent for her husband and father, told them what had happened, and killed herself. Lucretia's story remained an extraordinarily powerful image in Roman moral culture ever after. For many Romans, it represented a defining moment of female virtue. Lucretia voluntarily paid with her life for losing, as Livy put it, her pudictia, her chastity, or better, the fidelity, on the woman's part at least, that defined the relationship between Roman wife and husband. Yet other ancient writers found the story more difficult. There were poets and satirists who predictably questioned whether pudictia was really what a man wanted in a wife. In one bawdy epigram, Marcus Valerius Martialis, Martial for short, who wrote a whole series of clever, sparky and rude verses at the end of the 1st century CE, jokes that his wife can be a Lucretia by day if she wants, so long as she is a whore by night. In another quip, he wonders whether Lucretias are ever quite what they seem. Even the famous Lucretia, he fantasizes, enjoyed risque poems when her husband wasn't looking. More serious was the issue of Lucretia's culpability and the reasons for her suicide. To some Romans, it looked as if she was more concerned with her reputation than with real pudictia, which surely resided in the guilt or innocence of her mind, not her body, and would not have been remotely affected by false allegations of sex with a slave. In the early 5th century CE, St. Augustine, who was well versed in the pagan classics, wondered if Lucretia had been raped at all, for had she not, in the end, consented? It is not hard to detect here versions of some of our own arguments about rape and the issues of responsibility it raises. At the same time, this was seen as a fundamentally political moment, for in the story it leads directly to the expulsion of the kings and the start of the Free Republic. As soon as Lucretia stabbed herself, Lucius Junius Brutus, who had accompanied her husband to the scene, took the dagger from her body and, while her family were too distressed to speak, vowed to rid Rome of kings for ever. This was, of course, partly a retrospective prophecy, for the Brutus who, in 44 BCE, led the coup against Julius Caesar for his kingly ambitions, claimed descent from this Brutus. After ensuring support of the army and the people, who were appalled by the rape and fed up with labouring on the drain, Lucius Junius Brutus forced Tarquin and his sons into exile. The Tarquins did not give up without a fight. According to Livy's implausibly action-packed account, Tarquinius Superbus made an abortive attempt to stage a counter-revolution in the city and, when that failed, joined forces with King Lars Porsena of the Etruscan town of Colusium, who mounted a siege of Rome with the aim of restoring the monarchy, only to be defeated by the heroism of its newly liberated inhabitants. We read, for example, of the valiant Horatius Cocles, who single-handedly defended the bridge across the Tiber to block the advance of the Etruscan army. Some said he lost his life in the process, others that he returned home to a hero's welcome. And of the bravery of Cloelia, one of a group of young hostages taken by Porsena, who daringly made her way back home by swimming across the river. Livy suggests that the Etruscans were eventually so impressed by the character of the Romans that they simply abandoned Tarquin. There were, however, less patriotic versions. Pliny the Elder was not the only ancient scholar to believe that Lars Porsena became the king of Rome for a while. If so, he might have been another of those lost kings, and there might have been a very different end to the monarchy. Deserted by Porsena, as the standard story runs, Tarquin looked elsewhere for support. He was finally defeated in the 490s BCE, exact dates differ, together with some allies he had made in the nearby Latin towns, at the Battle of Lake Regulus, not far from Rome. It was a triumphant and certainly partly mythic moment in Roman history, for the gods Castor and Pollux were supposed to have been seen fighting on the Roman side and later watering their horses in the Roman Forum. A temple to them was erected there in gratitude for their help. Though many times rebuilt, this temple is still one of the landmarks of the Forum, a lasting Roman monument to getting rid of kings. The birth of liberty. The end of the monarchy was also the birth of liberty, and of the free Roman Republic. For the rest of Roman history, king, or rex, was a term of loathing in Roman politics, despite the fact that so many of Rome's defining institutions were supposed to have their origins in the regal period. There were any number of cases in the centuries that followed when the accusation that he was aiming at kingship brought a swift end to a man's political career. His royal name even proved disastrous for Lucretia's unfortunate widower, who, because he was a relation of the Tarquins, was shortly sent into exile. In foreign conflicts, too, kings were the most desirable of enemies. Over the next few hundred years, there was always a particular frisson when a triumphal procession through the streets of the city paraded some enemy king in all his regal finery, for the Roman populace to jeer and pelt. Needless to say, plenty of satire was also directed at those later Romans who happened to be landed with the surname Cognomen King. The fall of the Tarquins, sometimes, as the Romans had it, at the end of the 6th century BCE, amounted to a new start for Rome. The city began again, now as the Republic, or in Latin, Res Publica, meaning literally public thing or public affairs, and with a whole series of new foundation myths. One powerful tradition, for example, insisted that the great Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill, a building that came to be a major symbol of Roman power and was later replicated in many Roman cities abroad, was dedicated in the very first year of the new regime. True, it had been vowed, and, so it was often said, largely built under the kings, by Etruscan craftsmen. But the name of the formal dedicator blazoned across its facade was that of one of the leaders of the new republic, and whatever the exact chronology of its construction, which is, to be honest, irrecoverable, it came to be seen as a building that shared its birth with the republic and was a symbol of republican history itself. Indeed, for centuries, there was a Roman custom of each year hammering a nail into the temple's doorpost, not only marking the passing of Republican time, but also physically linking that time to the temple's structure. Even apparently natural features of Rome's cityscape were thought to have their origin in the Republic's first year. Many Romans knew, as well as modern geologists do, that the island in the middle of the River Tiber, where it flows through Rome, was in geological terms a relatively recent formation. But how and when did it emerge? Even now, there is no definitive answer to that. But one Roman idea dated its origin to the very beginning of Republican rule, when the grain that had been growing on the private land of the Tarquins was thrown into the river. Because the water level was low, this piled up on the riverbed and gradually, as it collected silt and other refuse, formed an island. It is as if the shape of the city was born only with the removal of the monarchy. Also born was a new form of government. As Tarquinius Superbus fled, the story goes, Brutus and, before his imminent exile, Lucretia's husband, Collatinus, straightaway became the first consuls of Rome. These were to be the most important defining officials of the new republic. Taking over many of the duties of the kings, they presided over the city's politics at home, and they led its soldiers in war. There was never any formal separation in Rome between such military and civilian roles. In that sense, despite being paraded as the antithesis of the kings, they represented the continuation of their power. One Greek theorist of Roman politics in the 2nd century BCE saw the consuls as a monarchical element in the Roman political system, and Livy insists that their insignia and badges of office were much the same as those of their kingly predecessors. But they embodied several key and decidedly unmonarchical principles of the new political regime. First, they were elected entirely by popular vote, not the half-and-half system of popular involvement that supposedly characterised the choice of king. Second, they held office for only a single year at a time, and one of their duties was to preside, as we saw Cicero doing in 63 BCE, over the election of their successors. Third, they held the office together, as a pair. Two central tenets of republican government were that office holding should always be temporary and that, except in emergencies when one man might need to take control for a short while, power should always be shared. As we shall see through the centuries that followed, these tenets were increasingly reiterated and became increasingly difficult to uphold. The consuls also gave their names to the year in which they held the office. It goes without saying that the Romans could not have used the modern Western system of dating that I have been adopting in this book, and for the sake of clarity, readers will be relieved, will continue to use. The 6th century BCE would have meant nothing to them. Occasionally they calculated dates from the foundation of the city, when they had reached some kind of agreement about when that was, but usually they referred to years by the names of the consuls in office. What we call, for example, 63 BCE was for them the consulship of Marcus Tullius Cicero and Gaius Antonius Hybrida, and wine made when Opimius was consul, 121 BCE, was a particularly famous vintage. By Cicero's day, Romans had worked out a more or less complete list of consuls going back to the beginning of the Republic, and it was soon put on public display in the Forum, along with the list of triumphing generals. It was largely this roster that enabled them to pinpoint the precise date of the end of the monarchy, as by definition it had to correlate with the date of the first consul. The Republic, in other words, was not just a political system. It was a complex set of interrelationships between politics, time, geography, and the Roman cityscape. Dates were directly correlated with the elected consuls. Years were marked by the nails hammered into the temple, whose dedication was traced back to the first year of the new regime. Even the island in the Tiber was a product, quite literally, of the expulsion of the kings. Underpinning the whole thing was one single overriding principle, namely freedom, or libertas. 5th century BCE Athens bequeathed the idea of democracy to the modern world after the Athenian tyrants were deposed and democratic institutions established at the end of the 6th century BCE, a chronological match with the expulsion of the Roman kings that was not lost on ancient observers, who were keen to present the history of the two places as if they ran in parallel. Republican Rome bequeathed the equally important idea of liberty. The first word of the second book of Livy's history, which begins the story of Rome after the monarchy, is free, and the words free and freedom are together repeated 8 times in the first few lines alone. The idea that the Republic was founded on libertas rings loudly throughout Roman literature, and it has echoed through radical movements in later centuries in Europe and America. It is no coincidence that the slogan of the French Revolution, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, puts liberty in pride of place, nor that George Washington spoke of restoring the sacred fire of liberty to the West, nor that the drafters of the United States Constitution defended it under the pseudonym of Publius, taken from the name of Publius Valerius Publicola, another of the earliest consuls of the Republic. But how was Roman liberty to be defined? That was a controversial question in Roman political culture for the next 800 years. Through the Republic and into the one-man rule of the Roman Empire, when political debate often turned on how far libertas could ever be compatible with autocracy. Whose liberty was at stake? How was it most effectively defended? How could conflicting versions of the freedom of the Roman citizen be resolved? All or most Romans would have counted themselves as upholders of libertas, just as today most of us uphold democracy. But there were repeated and intense conflicts over what that meant. We have already seen that when Cicero was sent into exile, his house was demolished and a shrine of libertas erected on its site. Not everyone would have approved. Cicero himself tells how, during the performance of a play on the theme of Brutus, the first consul of the Republic, the crowd burst into applause at a line spoken by one of the characters, "Tullius, who underpinned the citizens' liberty." The play was actually referring to Servius Tullius and suggesting that liberty might have had a prehistory at Rome before the Republic, under a good king. But Marcus Tullius Cicero, to give him his full name, was convinced, maybe rightly, that the applause was for him. Conflicts of this kind form one important theme in the chapters that follow. But before we explore the history of Rome in the first centuries of the Republic, the warfare at home, the victories for liberty, and the military victories over Rome's neighbours in Italy, we must look a little harder at the story of the birth of the Republic and the invention of the consulship. Predictably, perhaps, it was not quite as smooth a process as the standard story, which I have given so far, makes it appear. Chapter 4. Rome's Great Leap Forward. 2 centuries of change, from the Tarquins to Scipio Longbeard. How did the Republic really begin? Ancient Roman historians were expert at turning historical chaos into a tidy narrative, and always keen to imagine that their familiar institutions went back much further than they really did. For them, the transition from monarchy to republic was as smooth as any revolution could be. The Tarquins fled, the new form of government emerged fully formed, the consulship was instantly established, providing the new order with its chronology from year 1. In reality, the whole process must have been more gradual than that story suggests, and messier. The Republic was born slowly over a period of decades, if not centuries. It was reinvented many times over. Even the consuls did not go back to the beginning of the new regime. Livy hints that the highest official in the state, and the one whose job it was to bang the nail into the Temple of Jupiter each year, was originally called the chief praetor, although the word praetor was later used for a junior official below the consuls. There are other early titles recorded for those at the top of the political hierarchy, which only complicate the picture. These include dictator, usually described as a temporary position to cope with a military emergency, and without the decidedly negative modern connotations of the word, and military tribunes with consular power, a mouthful aptly translated by one modern historian as colonels. There is still a big question mark over when exactly the defining office of the Republic was invented, or when and why some other office was renamed consul, or even when the fundamental republican principle that power should always be shared was first defined. Chief praetor smacks of hierarchy, not equality. But whatever the key date or dates, the list of consuls on which the chronology of the Republic was based, going back in an unbroken series to Lucius Junius Brutus and Lucius Tarquinius Collatinus in 509 BCE, was, in its earliest parts, the product of a good deal of adjustment, imaginative inference, clever guesswork, and most likely outright invention. Livy conceded, looking back from the end of the 1st century BCE, that it was next to impossible to sort out with confidence the chronology of office holders in this early period. It was, he wrote, simply too long ago. There is also a question mark over how violent the fall of the monarchy was. The Romans envisaged a fairly bloodless regime change. Lucretia was the most prominent tragic casualty, but, though warfare was to follow, Tarquin was allowed to escape unscathed. The archaeological evidence suggests that the process of change within the city was not quite so peaceful. At least, layers of burnt debris that have been excavated in the Forum and elsewhere that are plausibly dated to around 500 BCE. They could be no more than the traces of an unfortunate series of accidental fires. There are enough to hint, however, that the overthrow of Tarquin might have been a bloody rather than a bloodless coup, and that most of the internal violence was patriotically written out of the standard narrative. The earliest known use of the word consul, in fact, dates from 200 years later. It turns up in the first surviving example of those thousand upon thousands of loquacious Roman epitaphs carefully carved on tombs all over the empire, both extravagant and humble, which tell us so much about the lives of the deceased, the offices they held, the jobs they did, their aims, aspirations, and anxieties. This one commemorates a man called Lucius Cornelius Scipio Barbatus. The last name means bearded, long beard, or perhaps beardy, and was displayed on the front of his oversized sarcophagus, which once lay in the family tomb of the Scipios just outside Rome, as burials were not usually allowed within the city itself. Barbatus was consul in 298 BCE, died around 280 BC, and almost certainly founded this ostentatious mausoleum, an unashamed promotion of the power and prestige of his family, one of the most prominent in the Republic. His seems to have been the first of more than 30 burials in it, and his coffin cum memorial was placed in the most prominent position, opposite the door. The epitaph was composed soon after his death. It is four lines long and must count as the earliest historical and biographical narrative to survive from ancient Rome. Short as it is one of the major turning points in our understanding of Roman history, for it provides hard, more or less contemporary information on Barbatus's career. quite different from the imaginative reconstructions, faint hints buried in the soil, or modern deductions about what must have been that surround the fall of the monarchy. It is eloquent on the ideology and worldview of the Roman elite at this period. Cornelius Lucius Scipio Barbatus, offspring of his father Gnaeus, a brave man and wise, whose appearance was a match for his virtus. He was consul and censor and aedile among you. He took Taurasia and Kithauna from Samnium. He subdued the whole of Lucania and took hostages. Whoever wrote it, presumably one of his heirs, extracted what seemed to be the highlights of Barbatus's career. At home, among you, he had been elected consul and censor, one of the two officials responsible for enrolling citizens and assessing their wealth, and he had held the more junior office of aedile, which by the 1st century BCE and probably earlier was largely concerned with the upkeep and supply of the city and with organizing public shows and games. Further afield, the boasts were of his military successes in southern Italy, a couple of 100 miles from Rome. He had captured 2 towns from the Samnites, a people with whom the Romans were repeatedly in conflict during Barbatus's lifetime. And he had subdued the region of Lucania, taking hostages from the enemy, a standard Roman method of guaranteeing good behaviour. These exploits underline the importance of warfare in the public image of leading Romans, but they also point to the military expansion of Rome at the beginning of the 3rd century BCE, now extending a long way from the city's back door. In a battle in 295 BCE, in which Barbatus served 3 years after he was consul, Roman forces defeated an Italian army at Sentinum, not far from modern Ancona. That was the biggest and bloodiest battle fought in the peninsula up to that date, and was so far from being merely local concern that the news travelled widely and quickly, even by the rudimentary methods of ancient communication, messengers, word of mouth, and on rare occasions, a system of beacons. Sitting in his study on the Greek island of Samos, hundreds of miles away, the 3rd century BCE historian Duris decided that it was an event worth recording. A brief snatch of his account still survives. Just as revealing are the other characteristics that the epitaph singles out for praise: Barbatus's bravery and wisdom, and the fact that his outward appearance was equal to his virtus. That may mean virtue in the modern sense, but it was often used more literally to refer to the collection of qualities that defined a man, vir. Virtue, in Roman terms, being the equivalent of manliness. Either way, Barbatus was a man who displayed his qualities on his face. Although the popular image of the Roman man is hardly of someone much bothered with his appearance, in this open, competitive, face-to-face society, the public figure was expected to look the part. As he walked through the forum, or stood up to address the people, his inner qualities were clearly revealed in how he looked. In Barbatus's case, unless he had simply inherited the name from his father, he sported a splendid beard, which may have been increasingly unusual at the time. One story has it that barbers first started to work in Rome in 300 BCE, and that for several centuries after that, most Romans went clean-shaven. Barbatus's Rome was very different from the Rome of the earliest Republic, 200 years before, and it had ceased to be ordinary. Vast by the standards of the time, the city was home, on a reasonable guess, to something between 60,000 and 90,000 people. That put it roughly in the same bracket as a handful of the biggest urban centres in the Mediterranean world. Athens, at this point, had a population of considerably less than half that number, and never in its history had more than 40,000 in the city itself. What is more, Rome controlled directly a large swathe of land stretching from coast to coast, with a total population of well over 500,000, and indirectly, by a series of agreements and alliances, much more, foreshadowing its later empire. It was a place whose organisation Cicero and his contemporaries, more than 2 centuries away, would have recognised. As well as the two annual consuls, there was a series of junior positions, including praetors and quaestors beneath them. Romans usually called these officials magistrates, but their function was not principally legal. The Senate, made up largely of those who had previously held public office, operated as a permanent council, and the hierarchical organisation of the citizens and the centuriate assembly, falsely attributed to King Servius Tullius, and warmly approved by Cicero, underpinned the working of Roman politics. There were other familiar aspects. These included an army organised in legions, the beginnings of an official system of coinage, and signs of an infrastructure to match the city's size and influence. The first aqueduct to bring water into the growing conurbation was constructed in 312 BCE, a watercourse that ran mostly underground for some 10 miles from the nearby hills, not one of those extraordinary aerial constructions that we often now mean by aqueduct. This was the brainchild of a contemporary of Barbatus, the energetic Appius Claudius Caecus, who in the same year also launched the first major Roman road, the Via Appia, the Appian Way named after him, leading straight south from Rome to Capua. For most of its length, its surface was at best gravel, not the impressive paving slabs we can still tread. But it was a useful route for Roman armies, a convenient means of more peaceful communication, and, in symbolic terms, a stamp of Roman power and control over the Italian landscape. It is no coincidence that for his great family tomb, Barbatus chose a prime position right beside it, at the city limits, for travellers going into and out of Rome to admire. It was at some point during this crucial period, between 500 BCE and 300 BCE, between the end of the Tarquins and the lifetime of Scipio Longbeard, that many of Rome's characteristic institutions took shape. Romans not only defined the basic principles of republican politics and liberties, but also began to develop the structures, the assumptions, and, to put it no more grandly, a way of doing things that underpinned their later imperial expansion. This involved a revolutionary formulation of what it was to be Roman, which defined their ideas of citizenship for centuries, set Rome apart from every other classical city-state, and eventually informed many modern views of the rights and responsibilities of the citizen. It was not for nothing that both Lord Palmerston and John F. Kennedy proudly broadcast the Latin phrase Civis Romanus Sum, I am a Roman citizen, as a slogan for their times. In short, Rome, for the first time, began to look Roman as we understand it, and as they understood it. The big question is, how did that happen? When and why, and what evidence survives to help explain or even describe Rome's great leap forward? The chronology remains murky, and it is absolutely impossible to reconstruct a reliable historical narrative. But it is possible to glimpse some fundamental changes both at home and in Rome's relations with the outside world. Later Roman writers presented a clear and dramatic story of the 5th and 4th centuries BCE. On the one hand, they told of a series of violent social conflicts within Rome itself, between a hereditary group of patrician families, who monopolised all political and religious power in the city, and the mass of the citizens, or plebeians, who were completely excluded. Gradually, in a vivid tale that involved strikes, mutinies, and yet another attempted rape, the plebeians won the right, or, as they would have put it, the freedom, to share power on more or less equal terms with the patricians. On the other hand, they stressed a series of major victories in battle that brought most of the Italian peninsula under Roman control. These started in 396 BCE when Rome's great local rival, the Etruscan town of Veii, fell after decades of warfare and ended roughly 100 years later when victory against the Samnites made Rome by far the biggest power base in Italy and caught the attention of Duris on Samnos. Not that this was a story of unchallenged expansion. Soon after the defeat of Veii in 390 BCE, a posse of marauding Gauls sacked Rome. Exactly who these people were is now impossible to know. Roman writers were not good at distinguishing between those whom it was convenient to lump together as barbarian tribes from the north, nor much interested in analysing their motives. But according to Livy, the effects were so devastating that the city had to be refounded yet again under the leadership of Marcus Furius Camillus, war leader, dictator, colonel, sometime exile, and another second Romulus. This narrative is based on firmer foundations than anything before. Admittedly, even in 300 BCE, the earliest Roman literature was still decades away, and the later accounts looking back to this period contained plenty of myth, embellishment, and fantasy. Camillus is probably not much less fictional than the first Romulus, and we have already seen how the words of Catiline were used to ventriloquise the speeches of an early republican revolutionary, none of whose words could possibly have survived. Yet the end of this period stands on the brink of history and history writing as we know it, far beyond a simple four-line epitaph. That is to say, when the well-connected senator, Fabius Pictor, who was born around 270 BCE, sat down to compose the first extended written account of Rome's past, he might well have remembered talking in his youth to people who had been eyewitnesses to events at the end of the 4th century BCE, or who had talked to men of Barbatus's generation, who were. Pictor's history does not survive beyond a few quotations in later writers, but it was famed in the ancient world. His name and a brief synopsis of his work have even been found painted on the walls of one of the few ancient libraries ever unearthed in Taormina in Sicily, a combination of advertisement and library catalogue. 2,000 years later, we can read Livy, who had read Pictor, who had talked to people who remembered the world as it was around 300 BCE, a fragile chain of connection deep into antiquity. Increasingly, too, fragments of contemporary evidence survive to set against the later Roman historical account or point to an alternative narrative. The career summary in Barbatus's epitaph is one of these. When Livy covers those years in his history, he writes of the Romans entering an alliance with, rather than subduing, Lucania, and he describes Barbatus fighting somewhere quite different in northern Italy, and not very successfully at that. True, Barbatus's epitaph is likely to have magnified his achievements, and subdued may have been how the Roman elite preferred to present an alliance, but the inscription probably does help to correct Livy's later, slightly garbled account. There are a number of other such fragments, including some striking paintings about the same time, which depict scenes from the wars in which Barbatus fought. Among the most remarkable and revealing of all, however, are the 80 or so short clauses from the first written collection of Roman rules and regulations, or laws, to use the rather grand term that most ancient writers adopt, put together in the mid-5th century BCE and laboriously reassembled, thanks to centuries of modern scholarly detective work. The collection is known as the 12 Tables, from the 12 bronze tablets on which it was originally inscribed and displayed. It offers a window onto some of the concerns of those earliest Republican Romans, from worries about magic or assault to such tricky questions as whether it was allowed to bury a corpse with its gold teeth in place, an incidental insight into the skill of ancient dentistry that archaeology confirms. So it is to the world of the 12 tables that we first turn before going on to explore the radical changes, both internal and external, that followed. Reconstructing the history of this period is an intriguing and sometimes tantalising process, and part of the fun comes from wondering how some of the pieces of the incomplete jigsaw puzzle fit together, and how to tell the difference between the fact and the fantasy. But there are enough pieces in place to be confident that the decisive change in Rome came in the 4th century BCE, in the generation of Barbatus and Appius Claudius Caecus, and that of their immediate predecessors. And that what happened then, hard as it is to pin down in detail, established a pattern of Roman politics at home and abroad, which lasted for centuries. The World of the Twelve Tables. The Republican regime started with a whimper rather than a bang. There are all kinds of stirring tales told by Roman historians of the new political order, of warfare on a grand scale over the first few decades of the 5th century BCE, and of larger-than-life heroes and villains who have become the stuff of modern legend too. Lucius Quinctius Cincinnatus, for example, who more than 2 millennia later gave his name to the American city of Cincinnati, is supposed to have returned from semi-exile in the 450s BCE to become dictator and lead Roman armies to victory against their enemies, before nobly retiring straight back to his farm without seeking further political glory. Gaius Marcius Coriolanus, by contrast, who inspired Shakespeare's Coriolanus, was reputedly a war hero turned traitor around 490 BCE, who joined forces with a different enemy and would have invaded his hometown had not his mother and wife intervened to dissuade him. But the reality was quite different and of much more modest dimensions. Whatever the political organisation of the city when the Tarquins were removed, archaeology makes it clear that for most of the 5th century BCE, Rome was not thriving at all. A 6th century BCE temple, that is sometimes linked to the name of Servius Tullius, was one of those buildings burnt down in the fires around 500 BCE, and it was not rebuilt for decades. And there was a definite decline in the imports of Greek pottery at the same time, which is a good indicator of levels of prosperity. Put simply, if the end of the regal period could reasonably be dubbed La Grande Roma dei Tarquini, the early years of the Republic were far less grand. As for the heroic warfare that bulks so large in Roman accounts, it may have played a significant part in the Roman imagination, but it was all very local, fought out within a few miles radius of the city. The likelihood is that this was traditional raiding between neighbouring communities or guerrilla attacks, later written up anachronistically as something more like formal military clashes. Much of it, no doubt, was still on a semi-private basis, drummed up by independent warlords. That, at least, is what one fabled incident in the early 470s BCE hints, when 306 Romans are said to have perished in an ambush. They were all said to be from a single family, the Fabii, plus their dependents, hangers-on and clients, more a large gang than an army. The Twelve Tables are the best antidote for those later heroising narratives. The original bronze tablets no longer survive, but some of their content has been preserved because later Romans looked on this motley collection of regulations as the beginning of their distinguished tradition of law. What had been inscribed on bronze was soon put into pamphlet form and was still being learnt by heart, so Cicero tells us, by schoolboys of the 1st century BCE. Long after the rules had any practical force, they continued to be reissued and re-edited, and several ancient scholarly commentaries were compiled on the meaning of the individual clauses, their legal importance and language, to the irritation of some lawyers in the 2nd century CE, who felt that their book-bound colleagues were rather too interested in the linguistic puzzles of old Roman precepts. None of this voluminous literature survives intact, but some of it is quoted or paraphrased in writing that does, and by scouring through this, including some of the remotest byways of Roman literature, scholars have tracked down the 80 or so clauses of those 5th century BCE tables. The whole process has been ferociously technical, and intricate debates still rage about the exact wording of the clauses. about how large and how representative a selection of the original they are, and about how accurate the later Roman scholars were in their quotations. Some modernizing has definitely gone on. The Latin looks archaic, but not quite archaic enough for the 5th century BCE, and on occasion, the paraphrases have tried to bring the original sense into line with later procedure in Roman law. In some cases, even learned Roman lawyers misunderstood what they read in the 12 tables. The idea that a defaulting debtor, who had several creditors, could be put to death and his body divided between them in appropriately sized pieces, according to the amount owed, looks like one such misunderstanding, or so many modern critics have hoped. All the same, these quotations offer the most direct route into mid-5th century BCE society, into its homes and families, worries and intellectual horizons. It is a much simpler society, and its horizons much more restricted than Livy's account ever implies. That is clear from the language and forms of expression as much as from the content. Although modern translations do their best to make it all sound fairly lucid, the original Latin wording is often far from that. In particular, the absence of nouns and differentiated pronouns can make it almost impossible to know who is doing what to whom. If he summons to law, he is to go. If he does not go, he is to call to witness, then is to seize him. Presumably means, as it is usually translated, if a plaintiff summons a defendant to law, the defendant is to go. If he does not go, the plaintiff is to call someone else to witness, then is to seize the defendant. But it does not exactly say that. All the signs are that whoever drafted this, and many other clauses, was still struggling to use written language to frame precise regulations, and that the conventions of logical argument and rational expression were very much in their infancy. Yet the mere attempt to create a formal record of this sort was an important stage in what is now often called state formation. One of the key turning points in many early societies is the rudimentary, usually very partial, codification of law. In ancient Athens, for example, the work of Draco in the 7th century BCE, though now a byword for harshness, draconian, was notable as the first attempt there to put what had been oral rules into writing. 1,000 years before that, in Babylon, Hammurabi's code did something similar. The 12 tables are much on that pattern. They are a long way from being a comprehensive legal code and may well never have been intended as such. Unless the range of surviving quotations is very misleading, they include almost nothing on public constitutional law. What they do imply is a commitment to agreed, shared, and publicly acknowledged procedures for resolving disputes, and some thought on dealing with practical and theoretical obstacles to that. What was to be done if the defendant was too elderly to come to meet the plaintiff? The plaintiff was to provide an animal to transport him. What was to happen if the guilty party was a child? The penalty in that case might be beating rather than hanging, a distinction that heralds our idea of the age of criminal responsibility. The themes of the regulations point to a world of multiple inequalities. There were slaves of various types, from defaulters on their loans who had fallen into some form of debt bondage, to those fully enslaved, presumably, though this is only a guess, captured in raiding or war. And their disadvantage was spelled out. The penalty for assault on a slave is set at half as much as for assault on a free man, whereas a slave could be punished with his life for an offence for which free citizens got off with not much more than a beating. But some slaves were eventually freed, as is clear from a reference to an ex-slave or libertus. There were hierarchies within the free citizen population too. One clause draws a distinction between patricians and plebeians, another between assidui, men of property, and proletariae, those without property, whose contribution to the city was the production of offspring, proles. Another refers to patrons and clients, and to a relationship of dependency and mutual obligation between richer and poorer citizens that remained important throughout Roman history. The basic principle was that the client depended on his patron for protection and assistance, financial and otherwise, in return for a variety of services rendered, including votes in elections. Later Roman writing is full of rather high-flown rhetoric from the patron class on the virtues of the relationship and miserable complaints from the side of the client about the humiliations they have to go through, all for a second-rate meal. In the 12 tables, the rule simply states, if a patron has done harm to his client, he is to be cursed, whatever that meant. For the most part, the 12 tables confront domestic problems with a heavy focus on family life, troublesome neighbours, private property, and death. They lay down procedures for the abandonment or killing of deformed babies, a practice common throughout antiquity, euphemistically known to modern scholars as exposure, for inheritance and for the proper conduct of funerals. Particular clauses prohibit women from tearing their cheeks in mourning, funeral pyres being built too close to someone's house, and the burial of gold, except dental gold, with the body. Criminal and accidental damage was another obvious concern. This was a world in which people worried about how to cope with their neighbour's tree overhanging their property. Solution? It had to be cut back to a specified height. Or with their neighbour's animals running amok. Solution? The damage had to be made good or the animals surrendered. They worried about thieves breaking in at night, which was to be punished more harshly than daylight theft. About vandals destroying their crops, or about stray weapons accidentally hitting the innocent. But just in case this all sounds a bit too familiar, it was also a world in which people worried about magic. What should you do if some enemy bewitched your crops or cast a spell on you? Sadly, the remedy for this is lost. To judge from the 12 tables, Rome in the mid-5th century BCE was an agricultural town, complex enough to recognise basic divisions between slave and free, and between different ranks of citizen, and sophisticated enough to have devised some formal civic procedures to deal consistently with disputes, to regulate social and family relations, and to impose some basic rules on such human activities as the disposal of the dead. But there is no evidence that it was more than that. The strikingly tentative formulation of the regulations, in places awkward or even confusing, should call into question some of the references in Livy and other ancient writers to complicated laws and treaties at this period. And the absence, at least from the selection of clauses preserved, of any reference to a specific public official apart from a Vestal Virgin, who, as a priestess, was to be free of her father's control, certainly does not suggest a dominant state apparatus. What is more, there is hardly any mention of the world outside Rome, beyond a couple of references to how particular rules applied to hostis, a foreigner or an enemy. The same Latin word significantly can mean both, and one possible reference to sail into slavery in foreign country across the Tiber, as a punishment of last resort for debt. Maybe this collection had an intentional internal rather than external focus. All the same, there is no hint in the 12 tables that this was a community putting a high priority on relations, whether of dominance, exploitation or friendship, beyond its locality. It all seems a world away from the age of Cicero, and even from the age of Barbatus and Appius Claudius Caecus, a little over 100 years later, with their parade of public offices, that new road striking south to Capua, and the boast about the hostages from Lucania. So what changed and when? The conflict of the orders. First, what happened in politics at home? The 12 tables,